a better way. Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, November the 21st, 2024. This is episode 3587 of the Survival Podcast, and since it's Thursday, it's time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week, and I have got a great lineup of stuff for you today, including one that will fit well with the fact that next week is Thanksgiving and the official kickoff of kind of the winter holiday season. So what do we got? Well, first we're going to lead off with something that has nothing to do with that. Chris Rossini and Dr. Paul will talk about how endless wars and empire must be put to an end. And right now, I'll have some comments on this because I think what we're seeing is a military-industrial complex, a neocon hardcore base. And by the way, neocons are often also liberals, right? So this whole neocon, neolib thing is really just all one and the same, this big mosh-posh. You know, all these senators, all these bureaucrats, people like Nikki Haley, they don't want this to go away. This is like, this is how they make their bread and butter. They make billions of dollars on death and destruction. And we're literally heading for a place where it won't matter if we have money if we nuke the whole fucking planet. But these people are hell-bent on holding on. And it looks like they're doing everything they can to start more conflict before the Orange Man cometh. I'm cautiously optimistic. I'll have some thoughts on this one. Then we're going to talk about things that are more pragmatic and close to home. Mike Melito will ask a question. Basically, what's the best American-made shotgun to buy? Well, that's a big ass. It depends. I'll have some thoughts on that because I am a shotgun fan. Jesse Markowitz will be talking about Bitcoin, but not in a technical way. More about Bitcoin and IRAs. So I'll have a little add-on with that one that says, get over your shit and think fully. And it's not about Jesse, it's about the person asking the question. Nick Ferguson says, is going to ask her a question on feeding rabbits. And basically the person's like, well, how much do I feed this food-devouring machine that I now have that's become a pet of my daughter's? Sean Mills will talk about a look at generators that get gummed up carburetors and how to avoid that. And I'll throw something out, and I'll remind you when I introduce Sean, because some people skip the intro. This will be Sean's second-to-last expert counsel segment, unless I hear otherwise. Sean has recently had one of those offers you can't refuse when it comes to going to work for a company that is going to suck up an awful lot of his time, so he will not have the time to be doing, you know, three or four expert counsel segments a week. I need a Sean Mills replacement. That is a tall order. But if you can answer the type of questions that Sean routinely answers on solar, generators, pumping equipment, stuff that a professional engineer with experience in alternative energy and homesteading understands, then I would love you to apply because losing Sean sucks, right? And it's not Sean's mad. It's not I'm mad. It's not we don't get along. We just hung out together for a long weekend at the workshop. He looked great, by the way. He's having to entertain people. He had to clean himself up and look a little less hillbilly. It's just he doesn't have the time. And so losing Sean is a big hit, you know. I got three or four people that are great on homesteading and permaculture, and I love them. They're great. But if I lose one, we got something to hold things together until we find somebody else. We lose Sean, we've lost like a whole segment of what we do. So I would love to hear from somebody that can step into that role. Doc Bones is going to talk about a pragmatic and level-headed look at H5N1 bird flu. And what he says is it's a little bit less dramatic than your recent guest talking about Colonel Miller. I agree, and I'll have some thoughts on Colonel Miller and the sky is falling syndrome when we play Doc Bones. Then Ken Daniels has two badass warm beverage recipes, a wassail and a champuruta, I think is how you say it, recipe for the holidays. And I think he said it more for Christmas, but I'm like, you know, because he's done one for the bank. I'm playing this one right away. You're going to probably have or go to a place with a lot of family or friends next week as we go into Thanksgiving weekend, which is one of my favorite holidays, by the way. Thanksgiving, I don't have to go anywhere. I don't have to dress up. Nobody tries to drag me to church. I eat lots of food. I drink booze. I see my family and my friends, and I watch football, and I take a nap, and I wake up and eat more food. You can't have a better man holiday than Thanksgiving, so I wanted to give you these two. And they are both virgin, I know adult beverage, but both can have adult beverage added, and that can be done after the fact. That way the kids and non-drinkers can enjoy too. And then we're going to talk about using ground venison for sausage when it comes prepped by a processor. So when I did my recent show on sausage making, when I did my live stream and workshop presentation on sausage, I said one of the things I like to do is prep my own meat. I don't like to use pre-ground meat because of my procedure and what have you. And also, I know exactly what meat I'm using. That doesn't mean you can't do it, but this guy has a really interesting question about meat-fat ratios. So we'll talk about what to do in this situation and what you can do in the future if you want more control over your venison when it comes down to making your own sausage. And just, this is all about how you communicate with your processor, assuming you have a good processor. With that, let's go ahead and remind you guys, if you like my show and you want us to keep sticking around here, then one of the best things you can do to ensure our future is become a member of the MSB. Now, I've made this as painless as possible. It's fixed $50 a year based on how many shows we do a year. That's about 18 cents an episode. Call it 20 cents, two dimes an episode. You choose to pay for the show. But inside the MSB is all these discount codes. And they are discount codes on everything, practical, tactical, gun to gardens, and everything in between. And like just one of the really high dollar discounts is a couple of our cannabis providers. If you're using cannabis product at all, you know, look into Angie's Garden, look into Akira Botanicals. The discounts on those alone, if you use a significant amount, might completely pay off your membership in one order. Then you look at things like if you want a Start 9 server, 9% on a Start 9 server, that's going to cover you for a couple years. And there's like 65 more discounters. I'm also always looking for new discounters, so if you have a product or service that you think our audience would be interested in and you'd like to be considered as an MSB supporting vendor, please email me a little bit about it and what you do. One thing on this. This is for people that have a business, not a website with one product on it that's been in business for a week, not people with an idea. I generally am looking for about a one-year track record from a business with some product that uniquely fits the needs of this audience, that has a track record of actually getting orders and shipping them. And so if that is you and you're interested, I would love to hear from you. Jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com is the email. TSPC in the subject line, and then send that to me. The other thing I will say before we go ahead and play our first one, if you want to ask questions of the expert counsel, same formula, but don't tell me about your product. Ask the question and tell me who it's for and then give me details. If you do not ask the question first in a single sentence, there is a 95% probability I will never read your email and I will delete it, because once I realize I have to filter through all your explanations to figure out your question, frankly, that's one of my filtering mechanisms and I don't have time. Questions for me, questions for expert counsel. The question, a single question, followed by a question mark, return key twice, put some space in there, give me your details. If you do that, everybody knows, including you, what you're asking, and we can get you a good answer. With that, let's hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on Endless Wars.
We can no longer pretend to run the world. We can't be the enemy of much of the world. We can't invade the world anymore. That time has passed. And I believe Trump, I don't know if he exactly believes something like that, but I believe he's moving in the right direction. He says the right words. I believe the American people are sick of the wars. We have to close the bases. We do not need 1,000 military bases around the world. Bring the troops home. And President Trump has to be resolute about this, no matter what circumstances are in front of him. And because things could be manipulated to, he's not going to do it now. You know, he has to be resolute and bring the troops home and use the trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars to tide over those troops. They're not going to be out on the street, and to help all the people that have become so dependent here in America. And even though we're libertarians and, you know, we're not big on the welfare state, we do have to realize that virtually half our country have become dependent on the government. So take the military empire out of the equation, and you can at least help the people that are on welfare for the time being so they can get themselves back on their feet.
You know, I think that's an important point, because I think it's easier, politically speaking. You don't have to go cutting child health care as the top of the list if you're trying to work our way out of it. But most people want peace. Most people don't realize how corrupt that system is. I mean, recently it's been in the public news, and we've talked about it on the program, is that the Pentagon never gets a satisfactory audit. So we don't even know where the money goes, and there's all lying and cheating in that outfit too, because the principle is even bad. The principle is take money from poor people in this country and pass it out to the arms manufacturers, and then go and store up problems to scare the people into doing it continuously.
It's a shame because America broke away from the British Empire. We became an empire ourselves, so we copied them in that respect. And here's another way that we copied what we broke away from. Here's right from the Declaration of Independence. It was one of the main complaints about King George III. It says, quote, "He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance," end quote. And is that not exactly what America has become? And it's the bureaucracy that has to be drastically cut. This is not just around the edges anymore. We've passed that point. And again, this is being talked about with the Trump administration, especially that DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, with Elon and Vivek. And I don't know what powers they're going to have. From what we understand so far, they won't. But they will have the power of exposing to the public what our government has become, to at least, because Congress is going to have to feel the pressure. They're going to be the ones that have to cut, and they're going to have to hear it from the public that you better cut this if you want our votes. And definitely Elon and Vivek can help in that regard. So that's a good thing. Again, as with the troops that you're bringing home, use the money, the trillions saved from cutting bureaucracy, to tide over the government employees that are being laid off necessarily. Don't want them on the streets either. Help them out, get them on their feet. And again, you know, we're minimizing the empire, minimizing the state, without, you know, throwing everything into disarray.
And that's why we have to have leaders in the country that can explain what's happening and why cutting spending is ultimately necessary. But, of course, with my opening statement, I said the way you cut spending can be, adjusted a bit. You don't start with the most popular thing on child medical care. But I don't mind them saying this, start with government education. You get rid of government education, we go a long way. We could get rid of that. But and I think more and more people will agree with us on that. But I think the original suggestion by Chris is go for our military industrial complex and all these unnecessary war. When I think back of the 60s with Vietnam and remembering a teacher in high school died in Korea, and it's on and on in the Middle East in my efforts to, you know, try to stand up against these useless wars. And yet I may have sent a message to some, but I tell you what, the wars have continued.
Let me outline the real challenge here. It's not just getting Congress to go along with it. It's that Americans always say they're for cutting spending. In general, even most Democrats say, yes, I'm for cutting spending. Now, of course, they mean the things they want cut. But if you're going to cut a budget, well, let's say you're going to cut a family budget, and 40% or let's say 30% of the family budget goes to housing, then you have to move, right? You have to move. And if like another 20% goes to the cars you drive, then you got to sell your car and buy a cheaper car. Or you're in a position where you can't do either, and you can't really cut the budget because over half your budget is completely non-discretionary. Now imagine a family trying to cut a budget where 80% of their budget truly is non-discretionary. They either must make this, like they have to have housing, they have to have transportation, they have to have electricity, right? These are non-discretionary. And there's either no room to cut or no ability to cut because there's no viable other option. You can say get cheaper cars, but when interest rates are much higher and you're driving this older car that's 3 or 4 years old, you still have a payment on it. And if you sold it, you'd literally be paying just as much for a shittier car. You don't sell the car. When you can't buy a new home because you have a good interest rate, but your payment's too high, buying a lesser home can literally result in a higher payment, even if you have equity to harvest, right? So we would all understand how that family would be like, I want to cut expenses, but I can't. Okay, so let's talk about where's the most spending in the U.S. federal government. Number one is Social Security. Number two is Medicare. Number three is Medicaid and other health programs. I'm going to tell you, even though the government breaks those three apart, I kind of put them all together. They are all forms of welfare, because Medicaid and other health programs is going to include things like everything except like unemployment and food assistance, right? Which we'll get to that in a second. So it's kind of all really one place, right? They got the FICA and the FUTA and then the SSI that you're paying. Like, but in the end, right, you're still looking at kind of the same chunk. It's all about making sure people that are of retirement age or in some way disabled have access to income and have access to medical care. Okay, how much do you think we can cut those in the and let's take a step back for a second, in the eyes of the average person? And what will Congress do immediately, every opponent to every person that's running for re-election in 2 years, do the second they talk about cutting anything out of them? They don't care about old people and sick people, and they want everyone to die in the streets, right? Okay, I'll get to how we can actually cut these programs without taking a dime from people that are actually dependent upon them in a second, but you see the problem. Okay, so that's the top three expenses that are like third rail, you can't touch them. What's the fourth highest expense? The Defense Department and National Security. Okay, there's plenty of waste there, but you know what will happen. Oh my God, they want us to be defenseless. They're going to cut the... See what I'm saying? Okay, so then you got number five, interest on the debt. Good luck cutting that. That's not something you get to cut. That's a non-discretionary expenditure. We owe $34 trillion. There's a lot of fucking interest on it. So your top five, they don't look like it can be cut very much. Number six is income security plan programs like unemployment and food assistance. You going to cut that? Really? What do you think the wailing and gnashing of teeth will be then? Oh, my God. Those are people that are unemployed. They're just looking for a new job. The benefits run out. We can't not give them unemployment insurance. Hell, they pay into it. They deserve to get out of it. Okay, sure. Food assistance. Oh, everybody's going to starve now. Okay. Now, so that one's kind of a part of the third rail system, right? What about number seven? Veterans benefits and services. Veterans benefits and services. You think you're going to cut that without wailing and gnashing of teeth? Number eight, education, training, and social services. There's probably more we can cut there than anywhere else, but we're all the way down to the eighth largest expenditure on the balance sheet. And we're still going to get wailing of gnashing of teeth. Nine, transportation infrastructure. More roads! Can't cut that. Number 10, national resources and environmental programs. Oh my God, they hate the earth. You see my problem for this whole idea. We're going to cut $2 trillion out of this, but our top 10 expenditures, probably 80% of the national budget, are all things that the average person's like, no, you can't. So what are you going to cut? What are you going to cut? Half of not of everything else? That's a 10% cut. And the way the government does cuts, that's you're going to grow at 10% instead of 20%. You see the problem. Now, let me tell you what has to be done to cut these programs. You don't have to cut how much money that you pay out in Social Security to cut the expense of Social Security as a line item in our balance sheet. How many people do you think work for the Social Security Administration that if they just disintegrated right now, everything would still work? The answer is a lot. How much waste is there? Like, this is what actually needs to be figured out. $1 is paid into Social Security. How much of that dollar disintegrates before it gets into an old person's hand? And how do we reduce that incineration of capital as it moves through the system? I did a study a long time ago, an informal study, that was based on all government spending. And I determined that the best way we could do government spending would be literally to take the money and just have it fall out of an airplane onto the country, and whoever finds it gets it. It would actually do more for the economy to do that than the way we spend it, because so little of it actually gets to the point at the end of it that actually needs doing, that actually requires capital. It came in somewhere around 15 cents on the dollar. Every dollar your government takes, it pisses away 85 cents before it actually does the thing that you want it to do. Most charities that you would not give your money to because they're too inefficient at dollars in versus mission out, do better than that. You could literally give retarded people money to hand out in envelopes on the street and do more to boost our economy and help people than the way we do it right now. So how are they going to do this? I don't know, but that's what it's going to take. It's not about cutting veterans' benefits. It's cutting the inefficiency on how a veteran's benefit is distributed. Because there's a shitload of people in these jobs, and there's a shitload of expense the government endures. You think this person makes $110,000 a year, so they cost $110,000 a year. No, they have to pay all the benefits to that asshole. That's $200,000 a year for that one person. But he needs an office, even though he may never go there. A lot of these people have offices they go to 1 or 2 days a month. They work from home. We're paying for these giant buildings. We're air conditioning. We're heating. We're maintaining them. And then how many people are maintaining that building that we don't even fucking need that could be sold off to the private sector to do something useful with? So, it's not just about cutting the budget. You have to cut the inefficiencies inside the organizations, and that's the only way to do this, because the idea you're going to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid that actually is paying to people who are beneficiaries of it is not doable. But you would be shocked if you actually analyze this at how much of the expense is nothing to do with an old lady getting a check to buy food with. It's the inefficiency of the Social Security office, the people that work there, the people that don't do jack diddly fuck for the world. Their jobs can be automated away tomorrow. And I'll finish with one more thing, because this went way longer than I intended. It could literally be my segment for today, but it won't. This is no different. It's just much bigger than what went on in New Jersey with toll booths. So all the way back in the early 2000s, when I was working the Northeast United States for Fluke Networks as the regional sales VP, there was a big debate every time I would drive around and through New Jersey on my way to New York City or to Connecticut or something like that about toll booths. And they were like, we have the technology right now to completely get rid of all the toll booths and all the people that work for the toll authority and do it all with automation. Like, the toll pass is not new, nor are cameras that can take a picture of your license plate and send you a bill. So we can get rid of all of this shit right now. But they wouldn't do it because it would cost jobs. This is the problem. It's not the only problem, but it's the biggest one. And the question is, instead of trying to cut expenditures, can people like Vivek and Elon get in and make the case to cut positions? And to increase efficiency, that's the way to do it. Because the other way, it really can't be done. There's no political will to do it. Let's move on and talk about shotguns with Mike Melito.
Hey, TSP. Got a question on shotguns, which I know that Jack and I both, because I'm a longtime listener, have an affinity for shotguns. When it comes to putting food on the table for like real-world defensive applications, it's hard to beat the shotgun. When it comes to versatility, nothing beats the shotgun. So I'm happy to answer a question on shotguns. Now this question comes from Goose. Best American made current production semi-auto shotgun. And I'm not here to tell you what you want to hear. I'm here to tell you the truth. I can't think of one. I asked for what purpose, he said, for hunting, but I'll cover a broad variety of this. A lot of times in guns, you get what you pay for. That's true with semi-auto shotguns. You can get a cheap semi-auto shotgun, or you can get a good semi-auto shotgun. If you want a good, cheap shotgun, get a pump action. If you want semi-auto and a shotgun, if you want a good one, the term a fine Italian shotgun is a thing for a reason. I don't think you're going to find any budget semi-auto that's going to go toe-to-toe with a Beretta A300, Beretta A400, or a Benelli M2, Super Black Eagle, any of those. You're just not. You might find one. You might find the Unicorn. Cheap semi-autos that runs and is reliable. He specifically mentioned like Savage and Mossberg. Now, I like both those companies, but I'm not a simp. I love Savage rifles. They make really good, affordable, accurate rifles. Their shotgun, and they're made in America. Their shotguns, however, he asked about American-made, and I love American-made, but I'm not sure about every model, but the Savage shotguns were made in China. He asked about Mossberg. Now, Mossberg, their pump actions are 500s or 590s are legendary and rock solid and awesome shotguns. Their semi-autos, I don't know about all of them, but I bought one not that long ago, a few years ago, thinking it was made in America. It was made in Turkey. So check, just because it says Mossberg does not mean it's made in America, sadly. And it was just a cheap Turkish shotgun. It was not a fine Italian shotgun. Now, if you want the best American-made shotgun, semi-auto, go find an older Remington 1100. It's not going to be cheap, probably. If you just want a shooter, you can find one. It's been a little bit beat up, well used in the field, not a collector. But the old Remington 1100s and or 1187s are fine American-made semi-auto shotguns. That's more of a collector gun, and they're beautiful, but that's more of a collector gun. If you're looking for a good hunting, shooting, American-made semi-auto, sadly, I can't think of a good American-made one. Again, the Mossbergs, the Savages semi-autos that I'm aware of, those are made in Turkey or made in China. The fact that I can no longer currently recommend that a current American production shotgun speaks to more than just this. You know, Sir John Glubb and the fate of empires. Think about the Golden Age, like an old Remington 760 or a pre-64 Winchester Model 70, the rifleman's rifle. Well, those aren't even made in America anymore. Winchester makes them, but they're made either in Portugal, not here, not in America, sadly. And again, going to like the decline of empire, just one small example of what's happened with Remington recently, and that saddens me because I love old Remington, but I can't in good conscience recommend a new Remington firearm. And they don't, as far as I'm aware, they don't make any semi-auto shotguns anymore. They don't make the 1100, 1187. Even the Mossberg semi-autos that I've dealt with, they're not a Beretta A300, Beretta A400, or a Benelli M2, Benelli Super Black Eagle. And I'm not just saying that because I'm Italian. Full disclosure, I am Italian. But Italians make some fine shotguns. If you want a fine American-made semi-auto, I applaud you for that. Go find an older 1100, 1187. One that's not so old that it doesn't have the REM choke, the Remington interchangeable choke system. And if you want good and affordable, go down to a pump. Nothing wrong with a good pump shotgun. I do like a semi-auto for a lot of reasons. If you want like a really good, modern, new semi-auto, it's not going to be American, but it's not going to be made in Turkey either. It's going to be a Beretta A3 A400, or it's going to be a Benelli Super Black Eagle if you're more into waterfowl, if you're more into all-around hunting shotgun, a Benelli M2, and if you're into the tactical, the gold standard for tactical semi-auto shotguns, the Benelli M4. The major difference is the Berettas are gas-operated and the Benellis are inertia operated. That's an entire episode in which on Gunfighter Life podcast, I have done an entire episode on that. But that's my thoughts. Remember, if you have gun questions, submit them for the expert council. Thanks, guys, and thanks, Jack, for having me on. Have a blessed day.
So I mostly agree with that. I was sitting there the whole time going, 1100, 1100, 1100. Then he got around to it. And I agree. If you're looking for an American-made semi-auto shotgun, that is the first place I would look. Here's where I'll disagree a little bit. The 1100's basic design has not changed since it was released in 1963. For full disclosure, I grew up shooting 870s and 1100s. I have fired 1100s, 410, 20-gauge, 16-gauge, 12-gauge. I've used them. Longer barrels, shorter barrels, you name it. Based on my assessment, if you insist on buying one made late enough to have the REM choke system, you will only have about a few years before the internals, the quality of the internals changed. And the reliability of a newer 1100 is not what an older 1100 is. I would be looking for something made in the early 90s and back, and a sweet spot would be the 80s and the 70s. These were still really well made at the time. And there's a high degree of probability that if you find one of those, that it will not have a rem choke system. So then you go out and you spend a couple $100 to buy a barrel that has one. If the choke is not kind of like, if it has an improved cylinder and a 26-inch barrel, okay, or a skeet choke and a 26-inch barrel, you probably don't need to do anything with it, because I've probably put more birds into game bags using that exact setup than anything else. The sweet spot for that gun is not your 28, your 30-inch long-ass barrels. It is a 26-inch barrel. It makes it, if you're talking about hunting here, it makes it incredibly easy to move through the bush with. I've shot grouse with them. I've shot pheasants with them. I've shot ducks with them. I've shot geese with them. You name it. Having the flexibility of the rem choke, though, is really great. When you get into waterfowl hunting, turkey hunting, etc., you can go to like an improved modified or a full, or with turkeys maybe even like an extra full, super tight choke. That one gun, yes, it will be decent at home defense. It's not dedicated for it, but shotguns are shotguns and holes are holes. But that one gun, a good 80s to 70s model, 1100 in good repair that you take care of, will literally do. There is nothing that you would want to do as a hunter in North America that involves a shotgun that gun won't do for you. Including if you're a slug hunter, you buy a slug barrel, you throw it. It takes literally less than 1 minute to pull a barrel off and put another barrel on an 1100 or an 870. Very easy to maintain, very easy to work. The one place I really disagree with Mike is he used the term collector's gun. The 1100 was made in such numbers and was so popular, there are shit tons of them around today that will sell between $400 and $800. And if you don't want a collector's gun, if you don't want a show queen, buy one that's actually gone to the field and fucking done its job. And you want, and if you go to like a gun show, like these big gun shows we have in Texas, you will see plenty of them out there. The opportunity with 1100s today is a lot like Winchester Model 12 pump shotguns used to be back in the 70s. Back in the 70s, you could buy a Winchester Model 12 Featherweight, which is one of the most beautiful, from an ergonomics standpoint, shotgun ever made. That gun is light, and yet the recoil is nothing in it because it's so well designed. So unless you're shooting super heavy loads, like you're shooting like what you would go out and pheasant hunt with, you're shooting what you'd go out and dove hunt with, it is easy to handle. It only weighs like 6.25 pounds. You used to be able to buy them for about $250, right? Go find one in any decent shape today. Not just a Model 12, but a Model 12 Featherweight. They were made, you know, a little bit before and a little bit after the Second World War. Unbelievable the opportunity that existed back then. The 1100 today, you know, you're not buying it for $250, but in today's money, I'm sitting on guns.com right now. 48 results for Remington 1100 without even trying. Remington 1100, 26-inch barrel, 12-gauge. $600. Shape, very good. I'm almost thinking about buying it, even though I have a couple of them. Anyway, with that, let's move on and hear about Bitcoin and having stranded capital in IRAs that do not, as of yet anyway, have access to the ETFs and not really wanting an ETF. And what do you do about it?
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Today I have a question that's a bit less technical, more financial, but it's Bitcoin, so I figured I'd take a swing at it. The question is, should I take my money out of my Vanguard IRA, pay the penalties, and buy Bitcoin so I can hold my own keys? Details. I have a significant amount of money in a Vanguard IRA. Vanguard does not let me purchase a Bitcoin ETF. And even if I get a Bitcoin ETF, I still cannot hold the keys myself. I'm concerned about costs and penalties. What do I need to know? And what can I do? So, a lot to unpack here. Let me start with, I'm not a certified financial planner, CPA, attorney, all that stuff. So I'll walk through some of this from an educational perspective. But for your particular situation, you should talk to your own financial professional for that assistance. In addition, whenever you're going to change retirement strategies with a significant amount of money at stake, you need to take the time to think it through, make sure that you're really comfortable with what you plan on doing. Don't rush. Make sure you're comfortable with your plan before making any large financial moves. For those not familiar with IRAs, individual retirement accounts, the primary advantage of an IRA is the tax-advantaged growth of assets. Assets stored in an IRA can grow and even be exchanged within the IRA without having to pay capital gains taxes. This tax-free growth can be a significant benefit. There are two variations on IRAs. The traditional, we have tax-deductible contributions, tax-free growth, and then you pay taxes on the withdrawals as income on the back end. There are also Roth IRAs where the contributions are after tax, but you get your tax-free growth and then no taxes on the withdrawals on the back end. Along with the tax advantages, there are a number of restrictions as well, which you have to be aware of and careful about. Again, check with your tax professional. Make sure you're not going to trip yourself up on any of those details. The best answer I found for what you want to do is to open an IRA with Unchained. They are a company that specializes in Bitcoin storage and assisting people with holding their own keys and self-custodying their Bitcoin. They support you doing a rollover transfer where Vanguard sends all or some of your IRA money directly to Unchained. Unchained will buy the Bitcoin on a 2-of-3 multi-signature address where you hold two keys and they hold one. Unchained handles all the IRA paperwork for you and charges you a flat fee every year for maintaining the IRA. There's no tax implications, no penalties. You may have some fees to set up your Unchained account. They did waive fees in August. They may do so again. If you're in the Bitcoin world and a fan of Swan, Swan also has a Bitcoin IRA product. The way their Bitcoin IRA works is that they manage everything for you, including custodying of the Bitcoin, so you don't get the keys. Like Unchained, they can do a direct IRA to IRA transfer, so no penalties or tax issues. Their annual fee is calculated as a percent of the Bitcoin value, so if you have a larger nest egg, you're going to pay more. It's also possible to do a self-directed IRA where you can hold the keys and self-custody the Bitcoin, but that generally requires setting up an LLC, and you still need a company to work with you on the IRA paperwork. That tends to be a lot more work and more expensive. If you're just focused on capturing the value of Bitcoin in your IRA and not really concerned about holding the keys, then just purchasing a Bitcoin ETF is an easy answer. Well, not at Vanguard. You'd have to do that direct transfer to another IRA provider and purchase the Bitcoin ETF there. If you're committed to keeping your money at Vanguard, you could consider purchasing stock in a company in the Bitcoin space. You could look at MicroStrategy, a Bitcoin mining company, or other companies that are focused on Bitcoin. These would give you some exposure to the Bitcoin arena. This works for many people, and I personally own some Bitcoin company stock in my Vanguard IRA. For most folks, it is not the best answer because while those stocks will generally rise and fall with the price of Bitcoin, there is significant additional company risk on top of the Bitcoin risk. Finally, if you aren't concerned about the tax advantage of the IRA, in your situation, it may not be as much of an advantage as for others, you could just take the money from your Vanguard IRA and buy Bitcoin where you hold the keys. This would allow you to do anything you want with the Bitcoin. It gives you the maximum flexibility. You will likely have tax and potentially penalties to consider, but you would be free of all the IRA restrictions. If you're going to go down this route, do not take your money out and then try and figure out what you owe. Instead, look very carefully at the exact rules that apply to you. There are a number of exceptions where you can take the money out of an IRA without paying extra penalties. For example, first-time home buyers, extraordinary medical expenses, college expenses, and there are some other situations that are listed there that may allow you to waive the penalties. You will likely still have to pay some of the taxes owed on the gains, depending upon the type of IRA it is, how long it's been there, etc. It pays to look before you leap. I hope this has been helpful. If there's any other questions you have on Bitcoin, home technical issues, Start 9, other technical stuff, please get them into Jack. I love answering these questions and hope to do a bunch more. This has been Jesse Markowitz with your personal BitcoinAssistant.com.
Oh, just a few things real quick on this one to add. Number one, stop being afraid of fucking ETFs, okay? Just really. If your money cannot be extracted from an IRA or a 401k and you can figure out how to keep it, even if you move to a different provider, and then you can buy Bitcoin inside there, either directly or through an ETF. And when you're doing this with a retirement account, your entire purpose is wealth accumulation. Buy the fucking ETF and stop crying. I know that I'm a big advocate of self-custody and all. This is a different class of capital. The idea, you're going to get a 30 to 40% hit on your money to buy Bitcoin while it's at an all-time high, to be blunt, is asinine, and you shouldn't even think about doing it. And anybody that tells you to do it, you probably shouldn't listen to about that. And I don't think that's what Jesse told you to do. He gave you some other options to keep it from having that hit, like rolling it into a different program or something like that. And then if you roll it into something like Unchained Capital, you can actually hold your keys with a multi-sig, and their one key that they hold doesn't let them do anything, and you can have that. But the people that are so anti-ETF, this is what they don't understand, how Bitcoin works or how ETFs work, or one or the other. We know these ETF providers are holding the Bitcoin that they say they're holding because we already know what the addresses are. Because when you hold that much Bitcoin on a public blockchain, it's not hard to find. Two, ETFs are probably one of the most audited things in the world. And yeah, they could probably play some games with paper silver and paper gold. There is no such thing as paper Bitcoin because every Satoshi has a way to be tracked. That's one of the good things about the fact that it's not a privacy coin like a Monero, okay? That we can actually know for a fact you either have what you say you have or you do not. I have a tool that I use that was built on something called Dune to monitor ETF inflows and outflows, and we already know everybody's addresses, so we can stop playing this game. Now, the one thing I do want to say here, and this is really important, what kind of IRA or 401k do you have? Because if you follow the advice that we've given for almost 20 years, which is Roth, Roth, always Roth, and then Roth, okay, and you have a Roth IRA, then you can withdraw every penny you ever put in there, minus your accumulation, your gains, with no penalties, and then go buy whatever you want. Now, if you talk to your accountant or your financial advisor and they tell you that's not true, what you need to do is hang up the phone, and then you need to find a new accountant or a new financial advisor, because they do not know the square root of fuck all about one of the most basic fundamental tax policies of tax-deferred accounts that there are. What I'm saying is you have an IRA, you put $100,000 into it, and over time, and it now is worth $250,000. $150,000 is gains. You can't withdraw that without penalties. The $100,000 that you put in personally out of pocket, you can withdraw all of it. So if you only want a portion of it to go into Bitcoin, you still have that option as well. But if you do not have a clean option to get to buy Bitcoin directly, do not be afraid of ETFs. One more time, do not be afraid of ETFs. Do not be afraid of ETFs. If you have capital that can be spent any way that you want, it's not constrained by charter, i.e. you can only buy the funds in this program or whatever, then you should never buy an ETF. Okay? So it's not like, yay, Jack's all pro ETF. What I'm telling you is that the ETFs fit a certain classification of capital. And I would even give you an exception to that. If you're a high-frequency trader, the money you will save by trading in a discount brokerage using ETFs to trade Bitcoin in and out of the market, it will save you so much in fees, you're stupid if you're going to do it any other way. You're going to pay tax on any kind of thing you do like that anyway. There's too much reporting, even from the brokerage or the Bitcoin exchanges. So you might as well get lower fees on each transaction, and that would do that as well. If you're hodling long-term and you have free capital, please self-custody. But in other instances, use the tools that work. This is the same as when I say physical metal IRAs are stupid. They're stupid. They don't make any sense. The entire point when you have a deferred account is that you can trade, capture gains, and not pay taxes. And that means that the silver or gold ETF in your 401k or your IRA is immediately liquid and harvestable for gains. What is the point of a long-term deferred account if you never harvest any gains? Well, there's other tax advantages, but that's one of them. So, anyway, let's move on and talk about rabbits with Nick Ferguson.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com here with an expert counsel answer for Jerry on rabbit feeding. And he asks, how much should I feed my rabbit? Details, I got a free meat rabbit mail from a neighbor recently. I have no idea what breed. All I know is that it is light gray with blue eyes and currently weighs about 4 pounds. He can really eat a lot. I feed him food pellets, leaves from fruit trees, wild clover, carrot tops from the garden, some apples from my trees, and lots of other greens I pick from my 4-acre field. He is an eating machine. I figured I'd start with one rabbit and see if it's something I like doing. If I like it, I'd get a couple females later and start breeding. If I don't like doing rabbits, I only have one and could eat him at a later date. Then my 11-year-old granddaughter fell in love with him, named him Blueberry, and we built him a blue castle to live in. No Hassenpfeffer anytime soon. I guess I can still use his pellets for my worm bins and garden. Thanks for a great show and all the useful knowledge you share. Jerry. Well, it sounds like Blueberry is safe from the crock pot and probably best for your pending rabbitry to have live rabbits to breed and make bunnies anyway. So I would just keep him and let him be a king of the blue castle. I think you said it was blue. Let him be the king of the castle and get him some companions. And then you can eat the babies after they're grown. So honestly, dude, I would just go by whatever your bagged pellet feed says for a baseline daily amount to have in his hopper feeder. If you're feeding other things, then you can just make sure you change that out so it doesn't get moldy, and then use the excess, you know, moldier or old pellet feed that's been in his hopper feeder for a little while as, you know, just add it to the manure or your garden as just feed for your soil. And then for everything else, I would just feed small amounts of varied fresh feeds. Leaves, veggies, snacks like you have been doing. Have fun with it. Don't worry about the specific amounts. I like to have dry hay and tree hay available free choice, as well as a free choice mineral block and free choice pellet feed. And then each rabbit normally gets a good double handful of fresh greens like mulberry leaves, willow, poplar leaves, as well as any weeds out of the garden. That's really it. It's really simple, really straightforward. No need to get really complicated with it. You can go online and look up lists of all of the things that they can and can't eat. I just try to give them a nice varied diet. You're doing it already. I would probably just add in some of those fodder tree leaves. And try and make it a little bit easier. What you're doing right now sounds pretty complicated, and when you start multiplying that numerous times out, then yeah, you're gonna probably get kind of burnt out trying to feed a whole bunch of rabbits like you're feeding Blueberry there. So that's why I'm saying I would just try and streamline things a little bit. Make sure you have that pellet feed in there, and make sure they have some hay, and then just supplement with your fodder leaves and everything, and they're gonna eat that fresh stuff the first thing, and then if they're still hungry, then they'll kind of moderate themselves and kind of even out their diet with the hay and the pellets. So yeah, I would just keep it simple. Thanks for the questions. Keep them coming. Quick note on consulting tours. I'll be in Texas and the Southeast states the end of November and into December. So if you're interested in consult when I'm on the road and rates are cheaper, shoot me an email to nick@homegrownliberty.com with consulting in the subject line. And for those of you who are on my Telegram group for Rare Plant Store, you might be getting a special announcement around the 1st of December for some early bird pricing and early bird ordering on my plant packages and tree packages on rareplantstore.com. So check out that, and I hope you have a great weekend. Do good things.
Next up, Sean Mills on an issue with generators getting gummed up carburetors by not being run sufficiently long enough and not being run under load. At least that's what the person with the problem feels like the problem might be. And so I'm going to let Sean answer this. Just a reminder, because some of you skipped the intro. As I said in the intro, Sean will be doing one more expert segment. I already have it. He's already done. And that will be his last. It'll probably be the week after we come back from Thanksgiving. I'll run that. And I don't have a Sean Mills anymore. He's not been kicked off. He's not angry. He hasn't left in a tough or something. It's just the fact that he's taken a really great job. They threw a bunch of money at him, and he said yes. And with the requirements of it, he doesn't have time to do this anymore. If you'd like to step into that role, and I mean, that is some big shoes to fill. I get it. But this is one of the most important positions we have on the council. And unlike some other positions, we don't really have a lot of redundancy in it. Like, Sean talks about things that are beyond me and really not in the vein of any of the other council members. So we really need kind of a good professional engineer with experience with things like water flow rates and things like that, but also solar alternative energy as well. So if you think you fit the bill, TSPC expert in the subject line, and tell me a little bit about yourself. Don't give me your whole CV or nothing. You know, give me, you know, five sentences on who you are and what you do, and if it seems like it's a good fit, we'll give you kind of a test shot and see if it works out.
Hey, everybody. It's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and today I've got a question about generators from Matt. Matt says, what do I do if my gas-powered generator keeps getting their carburetors gummed up? What are the practical options? Options pitched to me include running these systems under load more frequently, or I can switch to ethanol-free gasoline, which is a long drive for me. I have two inverter generators. I was running them quarterly, but found that maintenance schedule led to them to have dirty carburetor and would either fail to start or crap out under load during a real-world event. During Hurricane Beryl, neither system performed adequately for backup power. The 4.5-kilowatt Briggs and Stratton would not start. I paid a mechanic after the storm to clean the carb for me, and he said that the jets were very small and liable to clog with the E10 gasoline common in my area. The 2kW Ryobi generator ran during the storm, but would drop voltage when more than 15% load was applied to the system. This let me save my meat freezers by a manual rotation system during the first day. After about 24 hours of running, the 2kW carburetor was cleared and could run under full load. Post-hurricane, I'm increasing my maintenance schedule to include every other month and have started using carb cleaner post-run. Are there any other options I'm not considering? Well, you didn't mention that you're adding fuel stabilizer, which is the number one thing you want to do with these internal combustion engines that aren't run regularly. Okay, so as you found, when you run a generator for a while, it kind of self-cleans, right? As long as you've got enough flow through those injectors, the flow itself will actually help to start cleaning. Most commercial gasolines these days actually have some detergents that are added that help keep that fuel system clean and working properly. So personally, I like Seafoam. What I would suggest that you do if you're going to go to a every other month maintenance schedule is a couple different things. So number one, you want to add the correct amount of Seafoam or Stable to your gas when you're adding new gas to your generator, okay? Number two, when you run your generator through this cycle, you want a heavy load on it. You want to be pushing a lot of gas and air through the fuel system, okay? So don't turn it on and let it run for 30 minutes and then turn it off. That's worse than not letting it run at all. Turn it on, put a bunch of stuff on it, run your 2K at about 1800 watts and really good, put a good load on it for about an hour, okay? Then take the load off, turn your fuel line off. There's normally a little ball valve on the fuel line. Turn that off and let the generator run dry or the carburetor run dry, okay? Then you want to close your choke fully and try to start it a couple times. What this is going to do is it's going to use up all the fuel that's in the fuel line and in the carburetor. Okay, so that's important. Then you're going to top off your gas tank, again, with the correct amount of stabilizer added to the fuel. All right, and so now, why did I say all that stuff? You have to understand what's actually happening here. There's really no problem with E10 gasoline. Okay, E10 gasoline is not what's causing your carburetor to gum up. Now, it is true that E10 gasoline will attract moisture, or at least the ethanol component, and that can cause problems within the gas tank. Okay, so the reason why we want to fill the gas tank up is we're reducing the amount of air. We're reducing the amount of air that's kind of able to come in and intermix with the gas in the tank, okay? So that's why we always want to store these with a full tank. We are running the fuel out of the carb and out of the fuel line because it's actually the fuel sitting in those lines that's starting to degrade that's actually causing the gum up problem, okay? If that wasn't the case, what you would have is your fuel would run or your system would run fine, and then it would start pulling stuff in from the gas tank, and then it would cause a problem, right? That's not what's happening. It's the fuel that you're leaving in the carb that is actually causing the problem. So dry out the carb by running it, not under load, but running it after you've turned the fuel ball valve to the closed position, and then top off that gas tank. If you do those two things, and then the other thing is, I would say, if it's been 12 months since you topped your tank off, you know, the first time in your maintenance schedule, drain the tank, use that fuel in something else, fill it back up with fresh stabilizer. I like Seafoam because it does a good job of stabilizing the fuel, preventing that breakdown that I mentioned that creates the varnish, as well as helping to clean the system while it's actually running. So I actually use Seafoam in my diesel. I use it in my gas vehicles and in all my generators and other internal combustion engines that I have around on the property. So that would be my suggestion. You do mention here as an additional note that the 4.5 kW generator will run the 18-inch electric Oregon chainsaw that Jack recommends. So when you're at maximum energy output on the chainsaw, the generator is reading a 90%. So basically you can really run that chainsaw as much as you want, and that 4,500 watt Briggs & Stratton inverter generator will handle it. So I did want to pass that along to everyone. With one of those, an electric chainsaw, you could probably do a lot of tree work. Thanks, Matt, for getting that question in. I hope everyone can get a little bit of value out of that. You guys keep getting those questions in the Jack, and I'll keep getting them answered.
Great stuff from Sean, and it's absolutely the way you should always shut down a generator. Now let's hear a little bit about bird flu, but not in like the sky is falling way. Let's hear about it a little bit more pragmatically from Old Doc Bones.
Hi, Joel Nendy here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, and co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning 4th edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, the number one ranked book in emergency medicine on Amazon, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Earlier this year, I wrote that the experts are sounding the alarm on H5N1 bird flu virus that has in the past infected wild and food-producing poultry, dairy cattle, and at the time, one dairy worker in the U.S. Since then, the government has increased testing of at-risk workers, identifying 52 human cases in the United States. All but one of these cases involved direct contact with the dairy and poultry industries. Now, before anyone yells the sky is falling, all of the documented cases so far in the U.S. in 2024 are alive and well, and no one has required hospitalization, in the U.S. at least. But testing of 115 dairy workers at one center revealed positive results in 8 cases. All had extensive contact with cattle, but experienced minimal or no symptoms. Influenza variants theoretically have the potential to be the source of the next pandemic, though. Some claim bird flu could be many times worse than COVID, pointing to a 50% death rate in some European and Asian outbreaks. This version, however, or clade, is not nearly as lethal, and no human-to-human transmission has been proven. Still, hundreds of herds of cattle and flocks of domesticated poultry have tested positive. Now, I will say that recently, a teenager in Canada has become that country's first case and is hospitalized. Of course, viruses mutate, and the wrong genetic turn could be reason to worry. A mutation that allows human-to-human transmission would change the whole dynamic of this particular outbreak. As humans exhibit little immunity against the virus once infected, they could be sitting ducks for the bird flu. Symptoms of H5N1 bird flu are pretty general. The CDC has documented the following in the cases seen so far. Eye redness, fever, cough, sore throat, nasal congestion, muscle aches, headaches, fatigue, and difficulty breathing. Less common symptoms include GI symptoms like diarrhea or nausea and vomiting, or neurological issues like convulsions. The worst cases get pneumonia, and that's where people get in trouble, or at least got in trouble in previous outbreaks. Factors like wild bird migrations, especially involving geese and ducks, could worsen the situation. Now, some researchers expect a bird flu pandemic in the future, but at present, the CDC does not consider community-wide outbreaks in the U.S. to be likely It does believe, however, there's a critical lag in testing workers that suggests more cases exist than previously thought. This could have consequences down the road unless more extensive testing in industry workers is performed. The CDC recently recommended that farm workers with significant bird flu exposure be tested for H5N1 whether or not they feel sick. Now that sounds simple, just test all the workers, right? Well, it's not so easy for several reasons. Farmers don't want their operations stopped if positive cases are identified. Many immigrant workers avoid submitting to blood testing or really any interaction at all with government officials. Besides, if they stay home from work in quarantine, they may not get paid. Still, testing agricultural workers could be important as the traditional flu season begins, because the question is, what kind of flu does a person have? The CDC also wants the antiviral Tamiflu, also known as oseltamivir, offered to workers who had a high risk exposure to H5N1 infected animals, especially those who didn't wear adequate personal protection equipment or PPE. Tamiflu is not just a treatment, by the way, it has a protective and preventative effect as well. The agency recently updated its recommendations to prioritize more PPE for those in higher risk activities, such as those working in milking parlors or in poultry culling operations where there might be splatter. Wearing such gear is not mandatory, however. Since milking zones are often hot and humid in spring and summer, most workers actually shun them or use them improperly. General recommendations for those who are involved in the poultry or other food-producing livestock industry include practicing proper and frequent hand hygiene, preparing food properly and safely, and avoidance of touching the face, mouth, nose, or eyes when in contact with animals or after using the restroom. This is good advice for general influenza, by the way. And the general public, additionally, I think, should avoid exposure to sick and dead wild and domesticated birds. If you see a sick or a dead bird, you probably should just stay away from it. You should avoid unprotected exposure to animal droppings and contaminated bedding, and avoid drinking raw milk. Pasteurization kills H5N1 viruses, so pasteurized milk is safe to drink. I guess I should talk about how you treat it. Pretty much just treat the symptoms. Runny nose, use a decongestant. Fever, use acetaminophen, etc. The patient should be better in a week or so, pretty much on their own, at least with this version of the bird flu. Although there's no cure for viral influenza, Tamiflu can give relief from symptoms and speed recovery. The key is to begin therapy within 2 days of the onset of symptoms. Let's face it, Americans are pretty much pandemic weary at this point, with Ebola, Zika, chikungunya, dengue, fever, enterovirus, D68, and COVID in the news all in the last decade. After COVID wound down, federal funding for pandemic preparedness, however, no longer has become a priority. There's about $335 million for pandemic issues earmarked for 2025, and that's well short of the CDC's request for $1 billion in their budget. Those with high levels of contact with poultry and cattle may consider influenza vaccination. But if you're just a regular citizen, right now no H5N1 vaccine is available to the general public in the U.S. And don't expect the availability of mass quantities of proven safe bird flu vaccine anytime soon. My impression, bottom line, I guess, from my last article on this subject hasn't changed. Despite new cases, no human-to-human transmission has been identified. The grand majority of cases seem to be restricted to workers in the poultry and dairy industries, and also in the grand majority, symptoms have been mild. We must be ever vigilant, however, and take precautions to avoid any type of influenza. Mutations happen, and if F5N1 suddenly starts transmitting from human to human, all bets are off. This is Joel Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, make sure to get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. And if you sign up at the website for our newsletter, you'll never miss our articles, podcasts, and video feeds, as well as get special discounts on important supplies.
I am not worried about this at all. I don't even care. There's another flu, okay? There's another flu. Until people start dropping over like flies from it and not fake ones in paper suits in China, I don't care. And you shouldn't either. Go on about your life. If you're a flu vaccine person, do whatever you want. Go get your flu. If you're not, don't do it either, because they don't have one for this yet. So, by the way, don't waste your time worrying about this, and that's why you're going to go get your flu vaccine. That's just stupidity. Okay, this is not a problem. There is a potential that at some point we could have an incredibly virulent and lethal, if not just heavy, severe illness flu beyond anything that we've experienced for a very long time. That can happen. Even if it does, society will continue, people will survive, and we will adapt, and the virus will move toward less lethal because they always do, because that's how they continue to propagate themselves and continue to exist. Just like I told you would happen with COVID. The difference is, I don't think people will allow the government to use one of these viruses in the future as an excuse to shut down society, at least not for decades to come. We will have to have a point where at least no one that was an adult is really still around in any significant numbers, I think, before people will tolerate this again. In any event, if it does happen, I'm not doing it. Like, I'm just not doing it. I'm not doing it. They can close whatever they want. I'm going wherever I want. If somebody opens their doors, I'll go there. If they don't go there, then, you know, that's their choice. But I'm not doing this ever again. I don't know about you guys. I'd love to hear from you. Who's ever letting them do this to us again? I mean, unless we're talking about airborne Ebola or something like that, they can all go get screwed. And I like hearing a pragmatic approach to this from Bones versus kind of the alarmist, eccentric version that so many people are spouting. Moving on, let's talk about drinks for the holiday season, especially when you have a bunch of people around. These are going to be two great ones, and I bet you a lot of bowls of this stuff is going to get made next week after you hear this.
Hello, this is Ken with DrinkEatLearn.com. Today's question is from Graham. He asks, with the holidays starting in a few days, a lot of my family is coming to visit. I feel like most cocktails are for the hot summer days. I was hoping for some cold weather drinks. I want to make it easy to serve guests without a lot of effort, not break the bank, and possibly impress the in-laws. Do you have any tips on what to serve? Graham, thank you for your question. Yeah, the holidays are just around the corner, and I actually believe that there's a big cold front coming around for most of us. If the family is coming over for the holiday party, I think I've got some solutions. I would recommend some warm cocktails designed to be served from a punch bowl or a crock pot. It would definitely be easy to self-serve. You could make it in advance, and it would hold for a long time with the added bonus that make the house smell incredible. Think like cinnamon spiced apple or rich chocolate. First up is a warm cocktail called Wassail. Wassail is a really old English drink. It's this spiced beverage that dates back to medieval times where it was enjoyed during the winter solstice celebration. I believe it brings good luck and prosperity and was shared among friends and family. The word wassail itself comes from the old Norse phrase vasel, meaning be healthy. It was originally a toast to good health and prosperity, and people would go door-to-door sharing this drink in celebration. I only tell you this so you can tell your in-laws and maybe impress them. But it's a relatively simple drink to prepare, requiring just a few ingredients and minimal effort, and it's fairly inexpensive. You can customize it to your taste by adjusting the spices and sweetness. Its warm, comforting flavors make a crowd pleaser and perfect for the holiday gatherings. So let's put this wassail together, right? So it's basically just apple cider or apple juice with brown sugar, some orange and lemon juice, cinnamon sticks, cloves, nutmeg, anise, and some ground ginger. You basically put all these ingredients in a crock pot, turn it on to low, let it cocktail warm up, and it'll fill your house with an incredible warm and cozy smell, and it's pretty much done. Have a guest self-serve with ladles into a mug, garnish with cinnamon sticks or orange slices if you desire. So also a simple variation to this wassail, just by changing the base ingredient, you can go from wassail to mulled wine just by changing apple cider to red wine. Same ingredients, just use red wine instead of apple cider. And I'm playing it a little loose with the exact differences with mulled wine and wassail, but in this context, it's okay. Let's not overthink this. Experiment and have fun. You can keep a bottle of rum or brandy next to the punch bowl, so if anybody wants to spike their own drink, it's right there. I add orange, lemon, slices or wheels, apple wedges in it, and I let them float around in the crock pot. It looks great, adds flavor and color, plus makes for an easy garnish when they do get ladled into the mug. So I love that drink. Second drink is called Champurrado. If you have trouble with this name, just consider it Mexican hot chocolate. But Champurrado is a thick, rich Mexican hot chocolate that's perfect for cold winter days. It's a traditional beverage that's been enjoyed for centuries in Mexico. Its origins date back way to like Aztec and Mayan times. The Spanish brought sugar and milk, and all this combined over centuries created this holiday drink. The name might be hard to say, but there's some advantages to this drink. The combination of Mexican chocolate like Abuelita and masa harina creates a thicker consistency than just regular chocolate. And if you don't know what masa harina is, it's basically corn kernels that have been soaked in lime water then ground. It's the same masa they make corn tortillas from. It's easy to find in the grocery store. Just ask if you get confused. The harina, when heated, thickens the hot chocolate. It's very rich and luxurious. This drink is perfect for warming up on a cold day. It takes a little more work than the wassail, but not by much. So the ingredients, you know, you've got the masa harina, the Mexican chocolate, pilsillo, which is like this Mexican sugar cane. You can use regular sugar, but it does help when you use the Mexican sugar cane. You can find that in the Mexican cooking section in the grocery store. We're going to use milk, cinnamon, and a pinch of cayenne pepper to spice things up a little bit. And so basically, you combine these ingredients in a large crock pot or just on the stove, stir it. I turn it on low, and I just let it do its thing. Now, traditionally, purists would say that I need to stir this constantly to avoid lumps, and I just say get an immersion blender and liquefy that sucker. Let it warm up. It's going to thicken. And if you see any lumps, blend it again. It holds for a long time. And if it gets too thick, add some water and stir. You're looking for a smooth consistency. Let your guest ladle into a mug. Again, set some rum or tequila on the side for those who want it. And I prefer to make these large self-serve cocktails actually as mocktails. It lets everyone enjoy, and those that want a nip of spirits can add as they choose. It also keeps the cost down for you. And based on the time limit, I've added an extra recipe on drinkeatlearn.com for another warm cocktail called Buttered Rum. If anyone is interested, you could go to the website and check it out. Graham, I hope this gives you some inspiration on some fun cocktails for your holiday gathering. If you need any advice or variation or how-to, don't hesitate to contact me. Good luck impressing those in-laws. Until next time, this is Ken with DrinkEatLearn.com. Cheers.
So I think I'm going to make wassail for Thanksgiving this year. And I think I'll put out something really nice as a bottle alongside of it. A rum would be a really great addition to that. So would a good bourbon. Or if you like spice, a good rye. And I have all of those. So thanks to some of you who brought me stuff like that. So I'll probably do that for my family. If you're going to do the Mexican hot chocolate thing, one of the things I found that really brings out hot chocolate is a high-proof peppermint schnapps. You don't need much of it. It's more of a flavor. And the alcohol kind of gets picked up by the heat and wafts into your nose. So like a Rumpelmintz. Or an Ice 101 or something like that would be kind of a go-to for that. It's more sugar, you know, but this is a holiday once or twice a year thing. This is not an everyday thing, so, you know, enjoy it while you can. I think I might reach out to Ken about coming up with an awesome eggnog for Christmas. And if you don't know about the nogger and anti-nogger war on Gun Twitter or Gun X now, you're missing out. It's kind of fun. Anyway, with that, let's talk about my segment today, which will probably be briefer than some of my other fill-ins. But this one comes from Jerry, and Jerry says, can I use ground venison burger for making sausage? Details, I have a local guy process all my deer. Having said that, I'm not sure what his fat ratio is, but it's pretty freaking good. He does use beef fat for this. I have about 60 pounds of ground venison, and our deer season goes to January. So I'm just thinking, what the F? I love venison burgers, chili, venison sausage, etc. If I use my already ground venison, I'm thinking it'll save me work of grinding it myself. Thank you for all you do and the great episode on sausage making. And I assume that's why he's asking this question, because I specifically said I like to season my meat and let it sit in the fridge in a meat tub overnight and then grind it after it's had time to get to know the seasoning. This is not necessary, it's just what I do, and I am generally not going to use a pre-ground product, so I have the opportunity to do it that way. I also break up my steps, not just for the culinary reasons, but for management reasons. I'm never making 5 pounds of sausage at a time. Kind of my minimum batch is about 12 pounds. That's a lot of meat to dice up. And so when I do that, I kind of want to do that, get my seasoning measured, get it on there, and be done for the day, and then it's a 4 or 5 day process when I make sausage, and that way each day is only an hour and a half of work, and then maybe half an hour cleanup, and that way I don't get overwhelmed and I continue to enjoy it. So you would actually shortcut that, even if you drew it out a little bit longer. So there's nothing wrong with this. On your fat ratio, most butchers who have any idea what they're doing, that are making a burger product, are probably aiming for 80-20. And perfect sausage meat is between 70-30 and 80-20. So you're probably fine just using it as is, and you probably don't need any additional fat added to it. To cover your base, you can ask your butcher, to let you know what is the fat ratio he's seeking. Let's say he's going a little bit more lean, he's cutting costs, for whatever reason. Maybe he's doing it because you paid for venison, you want mostly venison. So maybe he's like at a 90-10. All you need to do, if he tells you that, is increase the fat, let's say, by 10%. So if you were making a 15-pound batch, add another 1.5 of finely diced beef fat or pork fat to your mix. You would have to grind that yourself. It's not a lot to work to do, though, and you would definitely want to almost completely freeze pure fat when you're doing this, or you will make a big blech out of your grinder. In the future, if you're going to keep using this process, and it sounds like you are, it sounds like you're very happy with him, if he is on like the 90-10 track, you can ask him simply, what would you charge me to make sure all my ground is 80-20? Again, your ground's probably 80-20. I mean, that is the sweet spot for burger for everybody. So you could do this one way or another. The other thing you could do, if you didn't want to grind fat, you could literally weigh out rendered tallow and mix that into your sausage mix. As long as you get so you're going to want to bring it up in temperature just enough so it flows. You don't want it hot, because then you're putting hot on the meat, you start to cook it. But you want it to be just warm enough that you actually can massage it into your meat. I know this is starting to sound a little bit creepy, massaging your meat, rubbing your meat, cubing your meat. Okay, but it's the only way I can say it, right? That if you use like a good tallow product, you can up, let's say you had a 10-pound batch, you wanted 10% more fat, 10% rendered tallow would work in that, or rendered lard if you're okay with pork. So you can do any of those things to get the fat count up, but I'm going to bet you it sounds like your butcher knows what he's doing. You probably don't have to do anything except work out your seasonings and stuff like that. Now, from a standpoint of what I did when I used to make sausage out of venison at home, we would add 25%, not fat, but pork butt or pork shoulder. So that included some of the pork meat as well. So what exactly was our fat ratio in that? I don't know, but I know it came out really great. And pork shoulder back then when I was a kid was stupid cheap. And we used to literally go into the deli in the back of the store, pick out as much pork as we needed, take it to the butcher behind the counter and say, will you grind this on a coarse grind for me? And they would pre-grind it. So in that instance, back before I developed my method, we were grinding our own deer meat. We were having the butcher grind the pork, and we were combining them to make sausage. And it was damn good sausage. Looking back, though, I can say it was probably a little light on fat. It was probably a little light on fat and a little bit too easy to overcook. So if I was doing it today that way, I'm going to go more toward a pure fat addition, whether it be beef, whether it be pork. My favorite fat to use for this is the trim off packer cut briskets. The other fat that I like to use is sometimes I'll buy like a whole ribeye roast, like the whole primal and the fat cap, or I'll do New York strips as well. We'll go to Costco Business Center and do that. When I do that, the fat caps on those are huge, and I'll trim that down. I'll dice it up. I'll put it in 1-pound increments, and then I'll vacuum seal that and freeze it to use for sausage making and for other needs for fat. By going with 1-pound increments, if I need 3/4 of a pound, I'll throw a freaking pound in. If I need 1.1 pounds, I'll throw a freaking pound in. If I need 1.8 pounds, I'll throw 2 freaking pounds in. It doesn't have to be absolutely exact with this. So, longer answer probably than needed to be, but basically you probably could just go make your sausage. But, you know, if you have a good processor, he's not going to be upset that you called him and said, hey, Bill, when you make my deer burger, what's kind of your fat-lean ratio that you're shooting for? He'll probably be happy to tell you. It's 85-15. It's 80-20. Anything 85-15 or higher in fat, probably fine. If you get up into the 90 range, pitch some fat into your mix. With that, let's go ahead and wrap things up. Want to remind you that one of the ways you can support this show is do your online shopping at tspaz.com. That is tspaz.com. Since we talked a bit about cooking today, let's talk again about the meter block thermometer set. This thing is awesome. 4 probes. Each one is individual. They're all Bluetooth. When you're cooking that turkey, you put the probe in the turkey's breast, you close the oven door, and on your phone, it tells you exactly what the temperature of the turkey is. It tells you the ambient. It tells you how long it's going to cook. And it tells you when to pull it out and let carryover do the rest of the work. It records all your cooks. So you can look up the cook you did last time, where you feel like even though it said to pull it at this point, you wanted to leave it a little longer, a little shorter. You can see the differential, and you can make a better decision. The only downside to this thing is the probes are rather thick because they actually have, you know, electronics inside them beyond the ability to read a temperature. So they will not work on thinner cuts of meat. So you're looking at your 3/4-inch chops and steaks, your roasts, your turkey breasts, and things like that. They are fantastic. So fantastic, this is what I actually bought my son for a Christmas present last year. So not only do I own it, I've gifted it to family members, and there's probably nobody in my family that I care about as much as my son other than maybe my wife. And so that's what I chose to give him. So whether you need this for your own use or whether it's something you want to get for that foodie in your life as a gift, the only thing I will tell you, if you're going to buy this as a gift, they're about $180 on sale right now. That's a good sale. They're normally like $230 for this 4-probe set. Because they're expensive, make sure you're not buying somebody something like this that already has it or a similar product. Because if they don't have it and you get them this, they are going to go lose their minds happy about it. If you're like, I don't need 4 probes, when you look up the product in my write-up and you go over to the site, to Amazon to buy it, they do sell it as a single probe option as well. I think that's under $100. So if you're only going to use it for like individual roasts and turkeys, you can buy the lesser cost one. But I think once you bring this into your life, once you understand how much power and control it gives you when you're doing all the different things that you can do with it, you're probably going to wish you went ahead and bought the larger model. With that, I'll wrap up. Tomorrow will be a Friday flashback. And then next week, well, we have a short week. Monday and Tuesday will be new shows. Thursday we'll be rewinding the Keith Snow How to Cook Turkey episode because that one has helped out so many people in so many ways. And then we'll be off for Thursday and Black Friday. We'll be back the following week, regular scheduled programming. Oh, wait, actually, I lied to you. I don't like lying. I was wrong, and that's lying. Let me correct it. Tuesday we will run the Keith Snow show. Wednesday, we will run the survivalist view of Thanksgiving that was first done in 2008 from my car. Take care, guys. I'll catch you on Monday with one more new show before all that happens. Run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.